welcome to this episode of Military History Inside Out, presented by War Scholar. Today I speak with Charles Glass, who's written a book on two brothers who served for the British Special Operations Executive in Nazi-occupied France. They were secret agents who developed networks and committed sabotage, acts of sabotage against the Germans before D-Day and after. And the book discusses their exploits and, you know, the obstacles they face, their successes, that sort of thing. So thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with Charles Glass, author of They Fought Alone, The True Story of the Star Brothers, British Secret Agents in Nazi-Occupied France. Thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you.
So first, tell me, how did you get into studying and writing on this subject?
I'd written two books previously on the Second World War, and I came across information about special operations in occupied Europe. And that led me to an SOE, a special operations executive agent, a man called Tony Brooks. And I wanted to write a biography of Tony Brooks because he was the youngest agent infiltrated into German-occupied France, and he had a spectacular career. He was actually captured by Klaus Barbie in Lyon, and he was tortured, and he escaped, and he managed to talk his way out of it, and he helped to do to slow down the 2nd SS Panzer Division going to Normandy after D-Day. And he did a lot of great things. But in any case, when I started to research, I contacted someone who was called the SOE historian at the Foreign Office. He's the ex-SOE historian at the Foreign Office. And he told me he was already writing a biography of Tony Brooks, which meant, and he had all the papers already, so meant I couldn't do it. But he did point me in the direction of two men called George and John Starr, the Starr brothers, and I looked into their story. It actually turned out to be even more interesting, and I wrote a book about them.
So tell me about the book, then.
It's the story of their wartime careers. George and John Starr had an American father and an English mother, and the parents met when the father was the accountant for the Barnum and Bailey Circus, which had come over to England to tour England and the continent. They got married and had the boys and toured Europe. And so the boys grew up speaking French because they spent a lot of their childhood in France. When World War II broke out, they enlisted in the Royal Air Force, but the Royal Air Force wouldn't have them because they were, their father was American. At that time, they weren't taking anybody who wasn't pure British. So they enlisted in the Army. They went into the Army. They fought in the Battle of France, and when the British Army retreated at Dunkirk, they retreated as well, and they were continuing their military careers in England when they were recruited by this spy organization called Special Operations Executive because of their fluency in French, and they were successively infiltrated into occupied France.
So I see, so I have the book, it looks great. I guess you go through it chronologically, that makes sense, I would think. But are there, what would you say, with all the material you had to work with, what did you focus on, sort of, what was the theme that you wanted to get out?
The whole point of it was to tell their, tell the story of their careers in France, evading capture by the Germans and conducting sabotage operations against the Germans, and avoiding capture when a lot of their colleagues were captured, and when there were a lot of betrayals within the resistance, a lot of people turned traitor, and so how they survived, and then how one John, the younger brother, was in fact captured by the Germans and very, very badly tortured, and was taken to the Sicherheitsdienst, SD, Nazi police counter-espionage headquarters in Paris, in the Upper Foch, where he spent 18 months. And George Starr was operating out of southwest France, and he was not captured. And he was able to build up possibly the largest resistance network in France, which was more or less put on hold until D-Day, and then they went into full action, cutting all communications for the Germans, tearing down telephone poles, telegraph poles, smashing up the post office exchanges, blocking the roads with felled trees, ambushing German patrols, and making life hell for the Germans in southwest France, and then, at the same time, slowing down the advance of this SS Panzer Division, the Das Reich Division, which was going to go from southwest France up to Normandy to try and block the advance of the Americans from the beachhead. But they were delayed by 17 days by Stars and other resistance actions. And the story is really about the war and their exploits during the war, particularly after D-Day.
Now, I see that you've written other books on World War II. How would you say, how does this book compare to those? I'm not sure what their subject matter is or tone or that sort of thing.
Well, my first World War II book was called Americans in Paris, and that was about civilians. It was about the roughly 5,000 American civilians who were living in Paris before the war, mm-hmm. who decided to stay because they had family commitments or they had jobs or they liked Paris. They stayed and lived under the occupation. In 1940, when the Germans occupied, America was a neutral country, so they weren't arrested or molested in any way. In fact, they were treated rather well. Mm-hmm. It was only after Pearl Harbor that the Germans began to intern them, and some of them went into the resistance and some collaborated. So I wrote a book about that, and that was about civilians. Mm-hmm. The second World War II book was called Deserter, and that was about soldiers. And it was about the American and British soldiers who deserted from the armed forces during the war. There were 50,000 American troops deserted from the army during the war, and 100,000 British troops deserted from the army. And it was a story concentrating on four of them, the story of who they were and the pressures they were under and why they deserted. Mm-hmm. So this was then taking an oblique look at it through the activities of special forces. These people were neither civilians nor regular soldiers. Mm-hmm. They were organizers of resistance. They were sponsoring an insurgency, helping to arm local fighters to fight against the Germans.
I assume your previous research and writings sort of informed this one to some extent. Was there anything? Well, first of all, is that correct? And second, is that true?
Mainly, my understanding of the war helped, and my understanding of the strategy of the Allied commanders and the battles that took place were there from the previous two books. But this one was really self-contained because I hadn't done anything in the previous two books about special operations, mm-hmm. and so I learned a lot doing the research. And there was a lot of material in the archives in London and Paris, but particularly in the local archives in rural France, where when former resistance, the people who had fought in the resistance, when they died, they would leave their papers, their letters, their diaries, and so on, not to the national archives, but to local archives in the villages where they lived. And so I went around all these villages, particularly in southwest France, and dug out these documents and found some of the old resistance themselves to interview them.
Mm. Oh, okay. Because I did, reading the prologue of this book, you mentioned the three categories of French people at this time, you know, the resistance, those who collaborated, and those who sort of watched on the sidelines. So it just made me wonder if, as you wrote this book, there were parts where you said, oh, now this makes sense, you know, I researched and wrote about it, you know, in that first book, you know, that's what I was curious about, if this sort of rounded out some of the stuff you came across there.
Well, it told me a lot more about that small minority who resisted, and they were very brave, because resistance meant instant death if you were captured, or torture and then death if you were captured. Mm-hmm. And I knew about some of the ones in Paris from the first book, but I learned about the ones in rural France who were by far the majority mm-hmm. in this book.
So I don't want you to obviously give away too much about the book, you know, we want people to read it, but so these two brothers, how did they handle, you know, all the possible chances there were for someone to turn them in? You know, it must have been quite a paranoid kind of situation for them.
Well, George Starr was very security. He was the older brother. Mm-hmm. He was very security conscious. He didn't write anything down. He gave all of his instructions to couriers to go to people they knew and pass along the messages orally and then forget them. Mm-hmm. He lived in a village where he was completely secure, tiny village where the mayor was in the resistance. The mayor trusted him, and he trusted the mayor, a man called Roger Laribault. And Laribault even made George Starr a deputy mayor of the village and was able, therefore, to give him special papers so that he could drive around at night. I mean, if you weren't in the occupation, if you weren't a collaborator or a German, you weren't really allowed to drive around country roads, particularly at night. Mm. But George was, because the mayor had made him deputy mayor and a food inspector, so he had a very good cover. He also he kept a mustache, and the reason being that when it was easier to shave a mustache off if he had to look different than it would be to grow one if he were known to be clean shaved. Mm-hmm. So there was a million franc reward for his capture. There were posters with drawings of his likeness all around Southwest France for people to turn him in, but no one ever did turn him in. Mm-hmm.
Did he develop his own networks, or did he depend on the SOE to develop them, and he just was sort of inserted in and used them as he needed to?
Well, he was one of the first ones. He went in November of 1942, and there were very few agents there at that time. Mm-hmm. He had to create his own network called Wheelwright. Mm-hmm. But he did it on the basis of a local French network called Victoire that already existed. It existed in that village where he placed himself in the southwest, a tiny village called Castelnau-sur-l'Avignon, mm-hmm. where another resistant had taken him to live because this man's girlfriend, a woman called Jean Robert, was living as a teacher. And she took him into her house, and he lived in a guest room in her house. And he had a cover as being one of her family friends from the north who was retired and wanted to live in the peace and quiet of the southwest. So he was able to start with this réseau, the Victoire Network, and on that he built Wheelwright, which expanded from the village throughout the whole region of southwest France. Hmm.
So naturally the Germans, I'm sure, were very worried about resistance because, you know, obviously the French aren't appreciative of being invaded. So when the Germans caught resistance fighters, you know, and you said they tortured and killed, I think some Germans felt the French should be appreciative of them sort of fighting, you know, communism and that sort of, well, I guess it wouldn't have happened quite yet. But did the Germans, did they torture and kill out of anger? Or was it a more methodical, we torture to get information and we kill to keep this, to end the resistance? Or was there sort of a revenge factor too?
The revenge didn't come until after D-Day when the real uprising began. Before that, they would capture people and torture them for information to find out who the other agents and operatives were so that they could round them up as well, because they were attacking German soldiers, attacking German bases, blocking the roads, and making life difficult for the occupation. So it was part of their counter-espionage effort to make sure their forces in France were safe. Some of them, after having been tortured and dealt with, would then be sent to concentration camps in Germany, where many of them died. Mm-hmm.
Because there's a, I believe a German wrote this very well-known manual, which basically says, you know, treat your prisoners kindly, and they'll give you the information you want over time. Of course, it takes longer to get that information, but he was sort of anti-torture, so I'm curious if...
Who was that? I'm sorry.
I forget his name. It's a German interrogator wrote this manual. I'm pretty sure he's German.
I think that if you look at the records of the treatment that the Germans, the Gestapo, and the other intelligence agencies in occupied Europe, when they behave, you'll find that torture was common practice. Mm-hmm. That particular person may have adopted another strategy, but that was not the case in the majority of instances.
That's what I was curious about. I'm wondering if they ever tried to use honey, so to speak, rather than vinegar to turn any of these resistance, but maybe you didn't come across that sort of information.
In the case of John Starr, the younger brother, he was badly tortured in Dijon, where he was taken.
Mm-hmm.
He was moved to Avenue Foch in France. He had he was under the control of the counter-espionage chief there, a man called Major Hans Josef Kiefer.
Mm-hmm.
And Kiefer was not using torture on the SOE agents that he had. He had five cells in the top floor of the building, and his interrogators did not use torture for the most part mm-hmm. on them. And John Starr himself said he was very well treated by Kiefer.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't collaborate, didn't go over, but he had a very easy time there.
Mm-hmm. So was there a very robust German counterintelligence effort in France?
There was a very successful German counterintelligence effort, not only in France, but in all of the occupied territories.
Mm-hmm.
Famously in Holland, the German military intelligence was able to use captured Special Operations Executive radios to communicate with London as if they were still being run by SOE operators, and requesting that new agents and war material be airdropped into Holland, and they were all immediately taken. In a way, you could say SOE was supplying the Germans with weapons and food and other supplies for years.
Mm-hmm.
And to a lesser extent, the Major Kiefer's radio department in Paris was doing the same thing in deceiving SOE into sending agents to be captured and tons of equipment, which the Germans then used for themselves.
Mm. Was the SOE, were they very hands-on with the Stars, or did they just let them, go as they needed to?
Communications are very difficult, so each agent in the field was pretty much left to his own resources. He had to decide whom he could trust and how to operate. He knew the general strategy from London, and when he could communicate by radio to request supplies and so forth, he could find out if there was some specific request, for example, to blow up a gunpowder factory, which George Starr did. But in general, they were pretty much on their own.
And how did Churchill feel about the SOE and its efforts? Did he have...
Churchill loved SOE. He loved special operations. He liked the whole idea of this secret war. He is the founder of SOE. After the withdrawal from Dunkirk in the summer of 1940,
mm-hmm.
Churchill created SOE as his only way of getting at the Germans. They could use bombardment to a degree, but they could also use sabotage to harass the Germans until the British Army was strong enough again and had the Americans and the Russians on their side to resume the war properly against the Germans. But in the meantime, SOE's purpose was to make the Germans uncomfortable in Europe and make the Japanese uncomfortable in the areas they occupied in the Far East.
Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking, and this is a little beyond the scope of your book, but Enigma 2 and other things that Churchill had going on, sort of the intelligence war, did he just put guys in charge that he just let them go and do as they may, or was he very hands-on with running all this secret, these secret activities? Do you know?
The SOE war was run out of the SOE office in Baker Street. They were called Baker Street Irregulars, and the commander of it was a man called General Colin Gubbins, and he ran the operation. Churchill was not dealing with day-to-day affairs. He had many, many other things to worry about as well with the war.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me ask about the resources you used to do your research. Can you talk about that?
Well, as I said a minute ago, I went around all of these local archives in southwest France in particular,
mm-hmm.
Where former Resistance had left their papers. And I was able to go through all of those papers. I was able to interview some of them. I met a woman who was 101 when I interviewed her, who was called Madame Jeanne Robert, who was the teacher in Castelnau-sur-l'Auvignon, who had taken George Starr in and worked very closely with George Starr during the war, and was able to tell me about what kind of a man he was and where he had worked and how he had worked and how he got along with the people and how much he drank and what a really nice guy he was, actually, what an easy person he was to deal with. He was a real gentleman. Mm-hmm. And George Starr himself didn't like writing papers. He didn't think it was very important to leave reports, but he did leave a voice interview with the Imperial War Museum in London, which is very long and detailed, and so there was a lot of information there, a lot of information in the National Archives in London, National Archives in Paris, and family records from the Starr family and other families.
Mm-hmm. Did you come across any German records that would have informed this book, the writing of this book?
Most of the German records were destroyed during the war, during the bombardment, but there were a lot of the German counterintelligence people wrote their own books, mm-hmm. and I was able to use their books, but I didn't. All the relevant Germans from that time were dead.
Mm-hmm. And did you say, you said you went to the local French
archives,
excuse me. So did you tour around any of the locations that you wrote about?
I went to all the locations that I wrote about and took pictures of them. I went to the little bay where George Starr was brought in on a small sailing craft in November of 1942. Mm-hmm. And he was set ashore by the Polish captain of the sailing craft. And when he got on shore, a man had put his hand out to him to help him ashore. And when he jumped on the rocks, he looked in the eyes of the man and saw that it was his own brother, John, who was waiting to get to the boat to leave France.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and took a picture of that spot, and I went to the Castelnau-sur-l'Auvignon, a village where he spent his time, and interviewed old people who had worked with him, as well as the local mayor and the local historian, and they have an annual commemoration of the Battle of Castelnau-sur-l'Auvignon, which I'm invited to every year, and the people are really splendid. That's a part of France called Gascony, mm-hmm. where the people are known to be very hardy and tough. It's mountainous, it's rough. They live on meat and foie gras and duck and geese. And Cyril de Bergerac was a Gascon. They're swaggering, wonderful people. Actually, it was a good place for him to go and set up resistance, because they have a history of rebellion.
Mm-hmm. Did anyone show you sort of artifacts or any memorabilia that they kept from that time?
Yes, they have a little museum in the village with uniforms and weapons, mm-hmm. and photographs and maps.
Mm-hmm. And how many interviews would you say you did?
I would guess about 50.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a... And you said it was again, I'm sorry, I forget sort of the numbers you gave me, but what was the ratio between people who lived at that time versus people who were told stories by their parents or grandparents?
Well, you remember, everybody who was around and active at that time would have been their 90s or even over 100.
Yeah.
So very, very few. There were some that I met who were children at the time, mm-hmm. Who remember their own fathers going out with George Starr on missions, mm-hmm. and were able to tell me something about what their parents had told them. Mm-hmm. So there was both.
Did you hear any stories or come across any stories that seemed more legend than maybe accurate? Did you ever question any of the things you were told?
Most of these people were actually not bragging. They were telling very simple stories and admitting mistakes and talking about the failed operations, talking about the times they expected arms deliveries and they didn't come, mistakes that were made. I don't think that they were being outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and most of it gelled with the records from the time.
Mm-hmm. Did you get a sense from your interviews, was there more a sense of pride at liberating France, or more a sense of sorrow that it had to happen, that they had to do this?
I would say that the ones who participated in the resistance were very proud that they did, and that they didn't collaborate as so many of their neighbors did.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't find anybody who was particularly sad, no.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so in a place like this, but thinking about what you just said about Gascony, collaborating or just standing on the sidelines after the war seems like, I can imagine a bit of shame attached to that. Was it more like a let bygone? Because other parts of Europe, people were, I guess there was a lot of violence dealt on people who collaborated or didn't do anything. I'm just curious about this part of France, how it played out.
Well, Jean-Paul Sartre said after the war to the English, what you celebrated in pride, we celebrated in shame, because so many people did collaborate.
Mm-hmm.
There was something called the Épuration, the purging of France immediately after the liberation in 1944, where people were rounded up and killed or imprisoned, or women who had been prostitutes who had slept with German soldiers had their heads shaved and they were paraded naked through the streets. Mm-hmm. It was great punishment of collaborators and suspected collaborators, but often by people who themselves had much to be ashamed of.
Mm-hmm. Now, after the war, I would imagine that some of the resistance fighters and obviously the SOE might still want to maintain their secrecy. You know, you never know what might happen over the years. Did you see that, people coming forward and saying, oh, I was part of the resistance, or did they stay hidden for a while?
No, nobody stayed hidden. In fact, many people were claiming they were in the resistance when they were not.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many people called résistants of the 11th hour, those who joined at the last minute, because they could see that after the Allied invasion in June of 44, they could see how things were going, and they didn't want to be on the losing side.
What part of the research did you find most enjoyable?
It was interesting to me to talk to members of the Star family. It was interesting to me to meet Jean Robert, the woman who housed George Star. It was fascinating to go through the records of the time, read the letters, read also a lot of the denunciations and accusations back and forth between rival groups.
Mm-hmm.
The resistance was anything but united. There were communist resistance, there were right-wing resistance, there were monarchist resistance, there was resistance backed by SOE, resistance backed by De Gaulle. It was a very confused situation, and understanding some of the nuances of that was a real pleasure to get to know the country a little bit better.
Can you give an idea of the number of resistance groups there were?
Groups, there were hundreds.
Hundreds.
They were all local.
Mm-hmm.
There were attempts by de Gaulle's people to unite them, but the unity of them was not very strong, because you have to remember, under the occupation, communications from remote rural Gascony to Paris were non-existent. So you basically each group in its own area was on its own.
In a sense, despite the some of the stuff mentioned as far as, I think in your book, and maybe you just said, stealing weapons and that sort of thing, and just kind of working at cross purposes, there might be a sort of a strength in that, though, since you could, you know, if one were caught, the only one at risk, the only group at risk might have been that small group and not the others.
Well, there was that, but it was happening anyway. But many of the groups were based on the communist method of cells, small cells, so that one person would know the two people below him and one person above him, but no one else, so that if he were captured, he couldn't name a lot of names. And so George Starr, who was himself, prior to the war, virulently anti-communist, I'll explain why in a second,
mm-hmm.
but he said that the one thing he got from the communists was the cell structure, so that when he recruited people, other people who were recruited by him didn't know. But one of the reasons he was anti-communist was because he married a Spanish woman before the war, 1934, a woman called Pilar Canudas. And Pilar was from near Barcelona, from the village where St. Ignatius Loyola retreated, yeah. Manresa. And her family was on Franco's side in the war, so he sympathized with the Francoists. and didn't like the communists. However, in the fighting in France, he armed a Spanish communist brigade to work with his resistance forces, and they were very successful.
Hmm. Did you get a sense from your research that the resistance did, under the circumstances, did it work as well as it could possibly have, or did you see, and again, under the circumstances in which it existed, did you see inefficiencies that could have been...
Hundreds. This was an organization that before July 1940 did not exist.
Mm-hmm.
They recruited amateurs in the field. The normal intelligence people didn't want to have anything to do with them because there was already a British intelligence service called SIS, Secret Intelligence Service, also known as MI6, who didn't like SOE, felt it was in competition with SOE. Mm-hmm. Its mission, SIS's mission, was to gather intelligence quietly, and SOE's mission was to make a lot of noise by blowing things up, and the two conflicted. So the whole thing with SOE was they were finding their way in something called guerrilla warfare. The British had not been guerrilla warriors. The British had been putting down guerrilla wars in their colonies. They'd fought guerrillas in Ireland, they'd fought guerrillas in India, they'd fought guerrillas in the Far East, they'd fought guerrillas in Africa. Mm-hmm. They were used to putting them down. They were not used to supporting them. The only example they had, and this was an example that they named in their early documents, was Lawrence of Arabia, who organized Arab irregulars in Syria between 1916 and 1918 to fight against the Ottoman Empire. He was their great model, but they were finding their way. They made many mistakes, particularly in communications. When the Germans were playing their radio game, sending false signals, SOE in London should have caught that. They should have noticed that there was something wrong with those signals, and they shouldn't have been sending weapons and agents in to be captured.
Mm-hmm. I forget if you mentioned this earlier, did the brothers consider working for SIS at all, or was it straight to the SOE for them?
They didn't consider SOE either. They were recruited. Mm-hmm. They were regular soldiers, and they got a tap on the shoulder, each individually.
Mm-hmm.
John first, because of his French, and he went into SOE, and then he recommended that they recruit his brother.
Mm-hmm. And I guess in the book you explain how they were identified by SOE. Or how the brother was, the first brother?
In the book, I go into it in great detail, but it was mainly because every British soldier would be asked what his language skills were, and their language skills were not great, but some of them spoke fluent French because they had lived in France, and the Star Brothers were two of those.
And you do, and I I'd like people to read this in your book, but do you go into why the SIS didn't consider them to, I guess maybe they had a different way of recruiting, or?
SIS was a more professional organization. It existed for a long time. It already had its own networks and its own people.
Okay, interesting. What did you find that was most surprising in your research?
I was surprised at the end of the liberation at de Gaulle's treatment of the SOE agents who had fought so hard in his name to liberate parts of France. I mean, after the invasion of 1944, the resistance's mission was no longer mere harassing of the Germans. It was to support the Allied invasion and save Allied lives, which they did. And Eisenhower thanked them many times for doing so. And in areas where the armies were coming through, they found often that there would be resistance guides to help them and resistance who were cutting German communications and blocking the roads to make things better for the Allies. Mm-hmm. And in southwest France, because the Allied armies did not go there, the resistance itself liberated Toulouse and other cities and towns in the southwest without any army participation. And that should, in theory, have led de Gaulle to thank them. But in fact, what de Gaulle did was, in September of 1944, was he went all around France to meet SOE agents and kick them out of the country and humiliate them. He, with George Starr, he shouted at him and told him to get out of the country. And that did surprise me, because I would have thought that he should have given him a medal. Actually, a year later, they did give him a medal, but at that time, de Gaulle didn't trust the British, and he wanted all the British out, and he was calling many of the French who had fought with SOE mercenaries of the British.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think in the book you mentioned, again in the prologue, I think it's mentioned that either you said Roosevelt or Churchill really didn't like de Gaulle. Is that correct? One of those two?
Roosevelt detested de Gaulle, and he supported a man called General Henri Giraud to be the leader of the French, but that didn't pan out. Mm-hmm. Churchill helped to make de Gaulle. Churchill helped to bring de Gaulle out of France in the summer of 1940, mm-hmm. and gave him offices in London and allowed him to conduct his operations from there. Mm-hmm. But I think fundamentally they didn't like de Gaulle, and Churchill didn't like each other very much. Mm-hmm. But they had to work together, and Churchill was de Gaulle's man. But de Gaulle was always trying to assert his independence to be able to tell the French that he was not a British agent.
Mm-hmm. Wow, de Gaulle is interesting in that respect, that he just stands firm, I guess.
He was very brave. He stood alone in the summer of 1940 when the French army had gone over and capitulated to the Germans under Pétain, and he's one of the only ones who stood fast and said that France would ultimately prevail.
Mm-hmm. Was there anything you discovered that? And I imagine much of it moved you emotionally, but was there anything that particularly stands out, either moved you negatively or positively?
I was impressed by George Starr's ability not to communicate with his family. His wife and children were only about 200 miles away on the other side of the Spanish border, and he never sent them a single message to let them know where he was, how he was, or anything, because that would have broken his clandestine existence. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, his wife, Pilar, was working for SOE in Spain, helping with the escape network. George Starr and others would send airmen who had been shot down by the Germans, American, British, French, Polish, and other airmen who'd been shot down by the Germans, to escape to Spain. When they got to Spain, she would help them to get to Gibraltar in order to get back to England and fly again.
Mm-hmm.
So you could say the whole Starr family, the brothers and the wife, were all involved in resistance.
It's a family business, so to speak.
So to speak.
So apart from just telling their story, what do you hope the book will do?
I hope it will open people's eyes to how difficult the resistance was, how small it was in relation to the total French population. The French resistance was nowhere near as large as, say, the Italian resistance, which was much huger. Mm-hmm. But because it was so small, it says more for their bravery that this minority was willing to risk everything because they just didn't want this German occupation of their country to continue. And I would like people to take that away, but also to understand the importance of the British role. I mean, there are a lot of books in France, where I am now, about the resistance, and they tend, like de Gaulle himself, to downplay the British role. But without those British arms and the British communications, the resistance would have been even smaller than it was.
Mm-hmm. Now, I did a previous interview about a spy in Palestine during World War I, which prompts this question. Were there people in France who wished the resistance wouldn't cause the trouble that it caused for the Germans, because then the Germans would take it out on the population to some extent? Did you see that?
Definitely. Whenever there would be a resistance operation, hostages would be killed. Mm-hmm. And the famous massacre at Oie d'Orsogne during the second SS Panzer Division was trying to get to Normandy, and it was being blocked at every turn by the resistance. They took it out on this unarmed village, which hadn't been involved at all, mm-hmm. and massacred the entire population. They put the women and children into a church and burned them alive. Now, there was a lot of regret on the part of many people in the resistance at what the Germans did to the civilians as a result of their activities.
Mm-hmm. But did any French people who were not collaborators, but rather on the sideline, maybe privately tell people in the resistance, you know, stop doing this, the Germans take their revenge on us? Did you see any of that?
I didn't come across any evidence of that in the areas that I'm dealing with in the Southwest and in Burgundy, where John Starr was. Mm-hmm. And in the Southwest, George Starr was very considerate of the local population and went to great lengths to make sure that when his campaign began after D-Day, that there would be enough food and supplies for the civilian population, because he knew he needed them on his side.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine he cared about the people, too. I mean, it seems you do that, you can do that operationally to be successful, but I think you sort of have to have an emotional attachment, too, to be considerate to that extent.
Well, he seems to have been very popular in the village and in the surrounding areas, and he made a lot of friends for life from that time. Mm-hmm. So I think there was probably more to it, but the basic thing was operational. Most handbooks on guerrilla war will tell you you need the civilians on your side if you're going to win.
Mm-hmm. Can you speak to any difficulties you had in finishing the book or getting it published and how you overcame those?
There was no difficulty getting published. I presented a short synopsis to my publisher, who loved it immediately, so that wasn't a problem. Mm-hmm. The only difficulty writing it is I'm a terrible procrastinator and a very slow writer.
But as far as, did the book take longer than you expected it to take then, or...?
No, it seemed to go along pretty well. The material was all there, the people were there. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a terrible hardship. In fact, it was very enjoyable.
Okay, what's your next writing project?
I'm turning my focus to the First World War, and I'm going to write the story of a mental hospital for officers in the First World War who were suffering from shell shock, which is now called post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Mm-hmm. And the hospital was called Craig Lockhart, which was in the suburbs of Edinburgh. It was a place of revolutionary psychiatric treatment by two brilliant psychiatrists called Drs. River and Brock, who treated hundreds of officers for shell shock and treated notably two of the finest World War One poets, Siegfried Sassoon and Wilfred Owen. In fact, mm-hmm. Sassoon and Owen met at Craig Lockhart and helped each other with their poems.
Hmm. That sounds pretty fascinating. I'll just ask about that quickly. Did you come across, I don't know how deeply you've gotten into the research, but did you come across issues where if you didn't show enough or the right symptoms of shell shock, you might be considered more a coward than someone suffering from this?
A lot of people in the military high command, even when the war was over, said that all of those people with shell shock were shirkers. Mm. It clearly isn't the case, because there were still tens of thousands of them in mental hospitals 20 years after the war.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And when do you think that book will come out?
Well, I haven't started writing it yet. In fact, I'm doing some work in Syria at the moment, so I won't start researching and writing it until January.
Oh, okay. Okay. So where can people find your work? I assume on Amazon, but do you have a personal website or anything?
I have my own website, www.charlesglass.net, mm-hmm. and Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and any good bookshop.
Okay. So that's all the questions I have. Do you have any final thoughts?
Well, first, thank you very much for asking me about these things. Second, I hope people will take something from this book about the bravery of these two Anglo-American brothers whose story has never been told, which probably should have been told, and about the individual French and Spanish people who fought the Germans at great risk to themselves, and many of whom suffered for it, and many of whom were killed for it.
Well, thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. One of the best ways to provide feedback on this podcast is to rate it on iTunes. Please let me know if you liked it, or give me a poor rating if you didn't like this podcast, and I can use that feedback to hopefully get better. Otherwise, please follow me on Instagram at Chris Alvarez War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, on Twitter at War Scholar, on Facebook under War Scholar, And you can find more information on my website, warscholar.org. Please remember, my name, Chris, does not have an H. So it's CRISALVAREZ. Thank you, and I hope you continue to enjoy this podcast.